This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, I'm so glad you've joined us today. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're going to start today's show looking at the extraordinary situation unfolding in the Middle East right now with mass protests taking place in Lebanon and Iraq, both nations that have significant presence by Iran. We're going to talk about the pressures on Iran right now and how Iran may respond in light of the prophecies of the Bible. We'll talk about this with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal from Jerusalem. Australia is suffering from a serious drought, some say the worst in 400 years. It's devastating farms and towns. It's forcing ranchers to slaughter their starving herds. It's spiking food prices and squeezing Australia's economy. We're going to talk to one of the Trumpet's research staff who's been looking into this situation, Ariana Eames, to discuss the cause for this disaster. Then we're going to talk about fast food. Fast food is everywhere, and if you care about your health, it's a good idea to look behind the curtain at what is going into that burger and fries. We'll have a conversation with holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian about the science behind it, which is aimed at pleasing your taste buds while driving up profits. We actually recorded a segment with him in studio. Usually we catch him over Skype, but he was visiting us here, so we stick around for that very interesting conversation. And I'll conclude the program by talking about the importance of using wisdom in what you text or post online. We'll start, though, by talking about Iran with Brent Noctegal, whom we have via Skype from Jerusalem. Hello, Brent.
Hi.
So this is an important moment in the Middle East. We've been talking quite a bit lately about these protests in Lebanon and Iraq. If you would, first bring us up to speed by, I'd like you to describe how much Iran has done to establish its presence in these two nations, and then just give us a sense of the scale of these mass protests that are occurring there.
It's good to remember that these protests in both Lebanon and Iraq have been going on for almost a month now, and they have reached crisis point just because the lengths to which government officials are resorting to put down the protests, to get the protesters off the streets, it has turned deadly and it's turned violent, especially in Iraq. Both these countries have heavy influence by Iran in their internal politics. In Lebanon, that is done through Hezbollah, which is basically the model organization that Iran has developed over the past, let's say, 20 years to try and give it a fifth column within Lebanese society, at first saying that it was there or developing a militia to protect Lebanon from Israel, and then gradually entrenching itself into the political sphere as well, breaking from just being the resistance against Israel to actually holding political power. And it's done that now in the most recent elections a couple of years ago by winning some of the most seats in the Lebanese parliament, which gave it a lot of power over the rest of the Lebanese state. It never really had that until the, let's say, last 5 years. And Hezbollah makes no bones about it. They answer directly to Iran. They're funded by Iran. Decision-making comes from Iran. In terms of Iraq, Iran has always desired to exercise autonomy over Iraq, its neighbor, just because of they share a huge border. The trade is important between those two countries. Iraq has massive oil fields, and it's got a large Shiite population as well, which Iran sees itself as the leader of the Shiite Muslims wherever they are in the world. And so this really did come to a head with the fight against the Islamic State when the Iraqi military, which is independent largely or was independent of Iranian influence, struggled to fight against the Islamic State from 2014 onwards. And back then, there was a Shiite leader, the Shiite leader in Iraq, Sistani, that issued a religious decree that allowed for the formation of Shiite militias that weren't part of the official government structure, many of which answered and got funding not from anybody in Iraq, but from Iran. and that these Shiite militias would be allowed to be formed with Iraq's blessing to fight against the Islamic State because they were needed. They even fought alongside United States forces against the Islamic State. And as we wrote at the time, what happens when Islamic State dissolves because they are defeated? Then you have these Shiite militias that are not going to disband, that are now going to control much of the military structure in Iraq. And that's exactly what's happened over the past 2 years. With these Shiite militias, just as Hezbollah became a political party, now they have become political parties inside Lebanon, and yet they answer again to Iran. And so you've got massive power bases inside the government with these Iranian answering leaders that hold critical government ministries, be it finance ministry, oil ministry, health ministry. And then what they have done, and this gets to the heart of what a lot of these protests are about, especially in Iraq, is you have regular Iraqis that are unable to get jobs for the government, or unless they are affiliated with one of these Shiite groups. And so you have Iranians then, or Iranian decision makers, let's put it that way, that are Iraqis, but they answer to Iran, that again then giving Iraqi government contracts to Iranian-backed or Iranian followers inside Iraq. And so the people of Iraq are sick of it. Even lots of the Shiites are sick of it. And they've said, we need to bring down the entire Iraqi regime, which means we need to bring down the governance over our state and just put people in power who are, as they call, technocrats that don't have an affiliation to Iran or to a different sex. That is what they're calling for. And in the process, they've realized that Iran wants to hold the current system in place because that is how Iran gathers their strength inside Iraq and Iran. And so now the protests have morphed completely in Iraq, it seems, to an anti-Iran protest. They have been trying to burn down different Iranian consulates in the holy city of Karbala. They have been burning portraits of the Ayatollah and Rouhani and Qassem Soleimani inside in Iraq streets. And so they want to, the end of this protest for them sees Iraq as an independent nation, not answering to Iran.
You can't help but recall the war that raged between these two countries for most of the 1980s when Saddam Hussein was in power in Iraq. Obviously, there is a great deal of animosity within a certain segment of the population in Iraq toward Iran, and has been for decades. But the whole situation really was turned on its head when Saddam Hussein was removed from power, and suddenly the Shiites had a lot more of a presence within that country, that there were many Iraqis who had a certain amount of allegiance, at least religion-wise, to Iran. But you wouldn't expect the plan that Iran had to kind of take over Iraq to happen without some kind of resistance arising at some point. But it is quite extraordinary to see this taking place. And I think looking at this from a Bible prophecy standpoint, where we've talked, our editor-in-chief talked about how Iran would take over Iraq even before the Iraq War took place. Everything has been kind of moving along those lines, and now we have this kind of bump in the road. So we're seeing quite a bit of pressure on Iran in both of these arenas. And we're looking at these from the standpoint of Bible prophecy with an idea of how this will end up in both cases. Maybe you can just give us a nutshell view of how we would expect that to unfold.
So in the case of Lebanon, we know that is featured in an alliance that is mentioned in Psalm 83. That is an anti-Iranian alliance in many ways. And so we know that Lebanon, based on that, and we can give you an article to read up on that if you like. We could put it in the show notes, and that can give you the proof to show that Lebanon is eventually going to remove itself from Iran's hold. So that means that Hezbollah might actually experience a downfall inside Lebanon. Where it comes to Iraq, we've talked about, as you've said, that Iraq forms part of this King of the South alliance that Iran leads, that's based on a prophecy in Daniel chapter 11. And Iraq really does form an essential pillar of that, or a pillar nation of this kingdom, really, that gives Iran the power to act independently. Right now, the very fact that Iraq is an ally with Iran is helping it withstand the United States sanctions, because there's $12 billion worth of trade that goes back and forth between Iraq and Iran. They can function in that way. Electricity flows between Iraq and Iran. And so, and Iran, of course, has a huge border along Iraq. And Iraq, if Iran is going to have access to Syria and Lebanon to fund Hezbollah, it wants to, it really does need to control Iraqi territory. And so we can see, based on prophecy and even just geographic realities, that Iran is not going to want to lose Iraq and is going to fight tooth and nail to do so. Mm-hmm. That's why we see in Lebanon, the fragile situation hasn't resulted in any deaths of the protesters. In Iraq, it's resulted in 260 now deaths of protesters. And these were people that were killed by Shiite militias that answered to Iran. These were headshots. 70% of those killed died by a shot that was made to the head that was to try and discourage people from coming out into protest. But it hasn't happened. People are still massing on the streets. Mm. And there is no way that Iran is going to lose out in Iraq now with its gains that it has. It's never had as much power as it has right now. And, you know, we'll see where this goes, whether Iran actually sends some of its own forces to try and quell the violence. There was a report that came out yesterday that the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps head, Quds Force head, Qassam Soleimani, who basically brokered the last Iraqi government, set up the prime minister that's in power now, and who was over there on Wednesday telling the protesters to stand down, the government to keep fighting. He's basically said to the Shiite militias there, you do the job at stopping these protesters or we're coming as well. Mm. You could have Iranian soldiers now back in Iraq, well, fighting against the protesters in Iraq if these protesters aren't put down, just because Iraq forms such a valuable asset towards Iran's future expansionist goals.
Which, of course, would absolutely prove out exactly what the protesters are contending the problem is. So you were in Tel Aviv to listen to some experts on Iran. If you could, well, tell us what you learned. And I'm particularly interested in what you were saying about just not only these protests that are putting pressure on Iraq, but just the economic situation that Iran is in, putting pressure on Iran is what I meant to say, that that's not the only thing that might give us an indication as to what Iran's future might be.
The discussion that took place was involving three experts that have decades of experience in the Israeli intelligence field. They're not officially with the government right now, so they are a think tank. But based on that experience and what they see and the data that's coming in, they really do expect that Iran has bottomed out in terms of the United States' ability to pressure them financially. The United States has their maximum pressure campaign that has increasing sanctions on the regime, particularly the oil sanctions on the regime, to try and siphon off all the funds that Iran uses to export terrorism across the world, really. And the United States has been very successful at that. And the question they brought up is, what more can the United States do outside of military action to try and bring Iran around to negotiate a new nuclear deal to stop what it's doing across the Middle East? It seems like, according to them, and even data from the World Bank, that Iran's economy has reached the bottom. Yes, it's got crazy inflation. Yes, it's got high unemployment. The people are upset. But America has its maximum pressure campaign. Iran has its maximum resistance campaign, is what they're calling it. And they know how to smuggle in resources. They know how to smuggle out oil. They're still selling about $1 million of barrels per day, even though the United States has tried to cut that off. They're still getting income. And the World Bank expects their economy to actually grow by 0.5%. And so you see these sanctions coming out from the U.S. now, today. There was more sanctions. 10 individuals related to the Ayatollah were sanctioned by the U.S. And these experts were looking at this as being just the United States trying to clutch at something, trying to do a little bit more through sanctions to try and turn Iran's behavior around. But nobody sees it happening, especially when the president is in election year, when he doesn't want to exercise any type or increase the military footprint inside the Middle East, does not want it to look like he is a warmonger in the Middle East because that'll hurt him. And so
underlined by the fact that he drew out of Syria, that you could see where Iranians and Israelis would be looking at this situation and saying the United States has no stomach to get involved in this. We're on our own, essentially.
Yeah, they were talking about this new reality that we've entered into the Middle East, and it was very pessimistic. It was, even though Israel is strong, we can no longer be fully assured right now that the United States would come to our aid if we were engaged in a full frontal war against Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. They don't believe that the United States, under the leadership of President Trump, even though he is so pro-Israel and done all those pro-Israel things, they believe he cares for himself more than he does for protecting his allies in the Middle East. We have seen that. We have, not in terms of Israel, but other allies that you could say are peripheral allies. And even Michael Oren, the former ambassador to the United States, he had a dramatic piece that came out today showing how much Iran could do to hurt Israel's military. And it wasn't a pretty picture. And he concludes that by saying that the United States says it would come to our aid. And I believe them, he said, but I'm not 100% sure. And so Israel is scrambling right now to figure out how to defend itself by itself without the support of the United States. And in any war that Iran wages against Israel, there's going to be mass casualties in Israel. Because it takes so long to mobilize its forces, and Iran has so many threats now with all their guns, it seems, pointed at Israel.
Fascinating situation. If you're talking about essentially America's role in curbing Iran coming to an end, that this is basically showing the limits of what the United States is going to be able to do, and Iran and probably Israel recognizing this, Iran recognizing that it probably has something of a free hand to do what it wants to do with Iraq. And how that plays out, it does seem like the violence that we've seen could maybe just be a very small taste of what's to come if the resistance continued.
Yeah, I think that is the case. And here we are. I mean, even after the United States forces, hundreds of thousands of men that occupied and worked with Iraq for a decade, or almost a decade, and just to see how much money has been spent there, there is no way that the United States president is going to come to the aid militarily of these protesters. It's just not going to happen. And so they are on their own against what seems to be Iranian thugs that are operating inside Iraq, Iraqis that are doing it on behest of Iran, and potentially even Iranian soldiers breaching the border there and coming over to put down this rebellion. It does prove one thing. It does prove that Iraq has fallen to Iran even now, and the protesters may fight that, but Bible prophecy says it is not going to be, or they aren't going to be victorious in it. Iran cannot lose the gains it has in Iraq. It would set them back by decades on their plan for dominance in the Middle East, and they will fight for Iraq, as already we are seeing.
Watching all of this take place, given what we know about Bible prophecy, is quite something. We're watching this with a completely different perspective than the average Middle East observer, because we have these outlines, and the Bible gives quite a lot of detail about the way that this is all going to unfold. And we've been talking about this for three decades now, to see how the situation in Lebanon will unfold, to see America's role reduced in that region, to see Israel having to scramble to devise its own means of protecting itself. And you could see a certain level of desperation increasing in that situation without too much more pressure being put on it. To see the situation in Iraq unfold the way that it looks like it may very well do so, and Iran's role within the region, all of these have been defined quite clearly in Bible prophecy. So to see the way the situation is unfolding now, where every single one of those scenarios could unfold, this really could push toward exactly what we've been saying is happening. But we will have to watch very closely. There are definitely times where events take unexpected turns as they move toward their prophetic fulfillment. We're very glad that you are there to keep an eye on all of that for us, and we thank you very much for the conversation, Brent. We've been talking to trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about Iran and how it's responding to these pressures that it's facing right now. He's working on an article about this for the coming print edition of the Trumpet magazine, so do keep your eye on the website for that. Thanks so much, Brent.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Australia has been in a serious drought for 3 years. It's devastating farms across the country in what some say are the worst drought conditions in 4 centuries. We have an article up at thetrumpet.com about this. Australian drought reaches crisis point. And to talk about it, we have a member of our research team at The Trumpet from our office in England and a native to that region of the world, Ariana Eames. Hello, Ariana.
Hello, Mr. Hilliker.
It's great to have you here. So let's start by just talking about the weather. Tell us about the recent temperatures and the rainfall conditions that are causing these problems.
Well, the temperatures have been for the first 9 months of 2019, the average temperatures in Australia have been the highest since records have been kept, which they started being kept in 1910. And then also the average rainfall for the same period, the first 9 months of 2019, were at the lowest since 1965. But like you said earlier, they've been analyzing rainfall patterns for the last 800 years and have found that this drought is actually the worst drought in 400 years.
So how is it affecting the farms and the towns down there?
Well, it's affecting that part of the country in a lot of different ways. The temperatures and the lack of rainfall are actually at a very serious point now because they're rapidly approaching what the country is calling day zero, so when the taps run dry. So this affects the farms. They don't have water for their crops. They don't have water for their animals. And then just the daily life of those people affected. There are restrictions on drinking water, on just the water just for daily use, things that you don't even think about that are being restricted. And so because of this, crops aren't growing, which is affecting the crop production, which is in turn affecting the economy, but also further affecting farm life because these animals, the farm animals, are relying on the crops for food because the ground is not producing enough. So now all of the breeding stock are being sent to slaughter instead of being used for their purpose, just to gain what cash they can from these animals before they starve.
Yeah, that is really some of the most shocking information about what's happening down there. Maybe you could just talk more about just the dire conditions that so many of these farmers are finding themselves in. And how devastating this is. There are so many of them that really cannot afford to continue carrying on as farmers.
Yeah, this drought is literally destroying their livelihoods. So conditions are becoming so severe that in some areas, farmers are asking the government for aid to abandon their farms So basically, they've sent a letter to the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, for exit packages or financial aid to mitigate the loss of those forced to leave their livelihoods. So many are leaving their farms, and this is also affecting the mental health of farmers. There's an increase in suicides, an increase in domestic violence, and just tearing the lives of farmers around the country apart.
This trend that's happening where farmers are basically, they're trying to sell their cattle for whatever they can get for them, knowing that if they hold on to them to try to bring them to the normal term where they would before they would take them to slaughter, it shows just that they know that it's only going to get worse. And there's actually a paragraph there in this article that talks about just how overbooked the slaughterhouses are down there. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So the lack of water and feed is forcing the farmers to get what cash they can from the cattle before they starve. So the farmers are literally watching their animals starve to death. And so they're trying to just reduce the loss, because there will be a loss no matter what. They're trying to slaughter the animals, but the abattoirs are booked out in some cases 4 to 6 weeks. And some farmers just can't wait that long. For their farms that are without food and without water, the animals are just going to starve before they can be slaughtered and get any cash for them.
Can you tell us about just the areas that are being affected? This is really, this drought is impacting really some of the most important food producing regions of Australia. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the main areas that are affected by this drought are the southern portion of Queensland and much of New South Wales, especially the northern portion of New South Wales, which is actually where the Murray-Darling Basin lies, which is a large and complex river system, which is actually being called the food bowl of Australia. So it produces about a third of all of Australia's food. And the total storage for the entire Murray-Darling Basin, which actually covers a really large area, is at 41%. But in the most affected areas, which is the northern area of the basin towards the border between Queensland and New South Wales, this area is hit the worst and is now at 8% capacity, which is down from 27% this time last year. And even in this, portions of that are down to 1.5%.
So the amount of rain that it would take in order to replenish these supplies is just tremendous. Maybe you can just give us a little bit of an idea of what the forecast is going forward. Australia's in the southern hemisphere. You're just entering summer down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the predictions are that for this, just to provide relief for this drought, not even to cause any form of breaking the drought, would take months, several months of above average rainfall, which is really not likely because I have it here somewhere, but they're really not predicting any relief at all. With summer approaching, they're expecting one of the worst summers in a very long time, warmer temperatures, and summer usually brings the tropical cyclone season, and even in this, they're predicting reduced cyclones, so less rain than is normally expected.
Can you give us an idea of how this is affecting food prices and the Australian economy more generally?
Okay, well, this is obviously causing food prices around the country to rise because crop production is down, and meat, animals, all of that production is being reduced. So that's just raising prices. I don't know how to say this one, but one company has predicted that farm production will fall 5% in 2019 to 2020. And so the wheat industry is hit one of the hardest. Australia is the world's fourth largest wheat exporter, but this year, earlier this year, in around May, I think it was, it had to import wheat, which is the first time it's done that in 12 years. But this really is rare. And they just imported one shipment, but it shows the trend that the country is heading down. And if there's no relief, this is just going to become worse. So the overall winter crop production is 72% below the five-year average. And then crops such as the canola crop is 42% below the five-year average. So these are causing food prices to rise. And really just the entire agricultural industry is being affected by it.
And Australia is really known for its wool production as well. It's sheep herds. Those would be negatively impacted as well, wouldn't they?
Yes. So Australia is, I think it's the top wool producing country in the world. Let me just find it here. But yeah, the sheep flock is down, is reported to have reached a 100-year low. So the $2.1 billion, this is Australian dollar, industry supplies three quarters of the world's high quality merino wool. So with sheep flocks at a 100-year low, this is also having a major impact on the economy.
So whenever events like this come up, people want to blame climate change. But the real lesson in these types of events is far different than what it is commonly made out to be. We have a booklet called Why Natural Disasters that explains this. The third chapter of this booklet is called The Deadly Climate Change Deception. And I urge you to go to thetrumpet.com and find this chapter and read it. I'll just read you the first few paragraphs here. For our listeners who haven't read this booklet, when climate disasters occur, the usual political and media response is to blame the trend on climate change. The worse the disaster, the louder the calls for taking action against climate change by addressing the supposed man-made causes such as carbon emissions and the use of fossil fuels. This view about climate change has taken hold of millions of minds around the world. It's often presented as if it is irrefutable scientific fact. The truth, though, is that it is an ideology and will negatively affect every single person who falls for it. This is not a political view. We aim to give you God's view. Our great Creator knows that climate change is not the cause of weather disasters. This is such a critical perspective on events like this, as this article that we have on thetrumpet.com about this drought in Australia briefly brings out. There are many scriptures that show the real cause of events like this. And it does point back to human behavior. It is man-made in a sense, but this article quotes Leviticus 26, verses 3 and 4, which say, "If you walk in my statutes," this is God speaking, "and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit." It talks about abundance even in our cattle production and other agricultural elements. But it says in later verses in that chapter, "If you will not hearken unto me and will not do all these commandments, I'll make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass. Your land shall not yield her increase, neither shall the trees of the land yield their fruits." So it's all contingent on obedience to God. Obviously, this is a very unpopular view. It's something that most people would mock, but it couldn't be clearer in the Bible. And if you believe the Bible, you see not only the cause of crises like this drought in Australia, but you see how they could be solved. So it's really critical that our listeners understand that. And it's just remarkable to see the scale of the devastation that's taking place down there in Australia. We appreciate that very much, Ariana. We've been talking with Trumpet staff researcher Ariana Eames about this devastating drought in Australia. Do go to thetrumpet.com. On the front page, we have an article there, "Australian Drought Reaches Crisis Point." Read that, and also be sure to check out our free booklet, Why Natural Disasters, particularly that third chapter about the climate change deception. Thanks so much, Ariana.
Thank you for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour.
Fast food is everywhere, and it's hard to resist. It's convenient, it's inexpensive, it's tasty. Well, it's meant to be. Some of it is tasty, and it's also addictive. Most people know it's unhealthy, but they don't want to think about where it came from, how it was made, what it's doing to them. You know, there's a complicated science behind fast food and junk food aimed at pleasing the taste buds and driving up profits. If you care about your health, it's a good idea to look behind the curtain at what is going into that burger and fries. To talk about this, we have a regular guest. We're usually watching over a Skype connection, but who today is actually visiting our Edmond studio, certified holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian. Great to have you here face-to-face.
Great to be here and great to be in studio.
Yeah. So something tells me that as you're working with clients and you're trying to help them to clean up their diets, you're having regular conversations about fast food and junk food. Why do we crave it so much?
Well, it's a big industry. I mean, it's an industry that's driven, corporate driven, and it's not just the fact that we love the taste. I love the taste of a lot of food. But there's something special about junk food. It's a big business, $384 billion business. I mean, it's driven in a certain way, right? So, and our food budget, a big part of it goes towards those, towards that variety of food. So I think about 90% of some people's budgets. Mm. So it's quite big.
So, and you're characterizing fast food or junk food, 90% of your budget, that would include what, anything processed, or how much are people actually, say, going out and visiting fast food restaurants, that type of thing?
Well, it's hard to pin that one down. The statistics aren't certain. So when we say, if you say processed food, what we're going to talk about is something that would have additives added to it that would keep the food in a certain state. Mm-hmm. Whereas a whole food might not stay in that state, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the difference.
Okay, so huge industry, and what is it about it that makes us crave it?
Well, there's quite a sinister part to the story. You know, there's 10,000 new products every year. 10,000. So they're introduced into U.S. and that's one of the main reasons that people want these products is that they're designed to taste good. I mean, there's a careful science behind it. So I'll give you an example. You can think about Cheetos.
Mm-hmm. Now, perennial favorite Cheetos.
Absolutely. So they're made of corn fat, and something that's called cheese seasoning, and that in itself has like 11 ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And a Cheeto will melt in your mouth. It'll explode in the front of your tongue, and by the time you swallow it, you have no idea what you just ate. So in the insiders, they'll call it the height of food engineering.
Uh-huh.
So it's really incredible because it's one of the most marvelously constructed processed foods there is. Uh-huh. You can literally keep eating and not get full. So because your brain doesn't register calories.
Uh-huh.
So this is the apex of junk food, the Cheeto. And everything else is sort of, I would say, built around that concept. How do we get more of this into people?
Yeah.
This type of junk food, right?
So from a food manufacturer's standpoint, the fact that people don't get full on it is brilliant because they'll just keep on chugging those.
Well, the word brilliant is great from one aspect, for food manufacturer, of course. So there's certain factors that they look for. They look for mouthfeel. So mm-hmm. When you're crunching into something soft versus hard, you know, they'll have a hard outer part and then a soft center. And then they'll have a salivary response, which is like how pleasurable the food is in the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a big factor. And they work hard on that. And the other is a vanishing caloric density, and that's the Cheeto. Hmm. So that little puppy will disappear. By the time you swallow, you have no idea what you've just done. Mm-hmm. But your hand's already in a bag for the next one. So now Frito-Lays has a slogan, and manufacturers are so confident that their slogan is, "Bet you can't eat just one." Uh-huh. Now you just wonder, where did that come from? So they employ scientists that actually work on this, that work on the mouthfeel, that work on how fast you're going to eat it and your inability to stop eating. Huh. It's really something. And there's three things that work like magic in food: salt, sugar, and fat. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at Rockefeller University, and that's just one of the studies. There's hundreds and hundreds of studies. And so what they're doing is they're creating an imbalance, and you cannot stop eating. So that's the sinister part of it. We're not actually, I used to think there's a lot of willpower behind this, which is true. And I'd say, just stop eating. But your brain tells you not to. Mm. Now, we can't tell. We just say, well, that person might lack willpower. That's not necessarily true. So we're looking at that now. And these chemicals, these additives that they use, they create something that uses the same pathways that recreational drugs use. Mm. So you release all this dopamine, these feel-good chemicals, and you feel fantastic, right? But there's the part about this is that you build up what's called a tolerance. So if you use a drug, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. The first time you use it, they say it's just the best you're ever going to feel on a drug, if that you can call it that. It's the same with junk food. And then you're chasing that all the time. So you create that intolerance, and then you need larger doses. So mm-hmm. I would hate to say you need more Cheetos, but I guess that's really what it is. And then the second is the withdrawal. There's a physical and psychological component to it, just like a recreational drug. Now, I'm not one to say that it's the same as a recreational drug, the intensity, but the pathways that are being used by the brain are the same. They're shared for this. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is sinister if scientists do this on purpose. And there are scientists that have expressed regret in the past or mm-hmm. currently that have created these products.
So they're prioritizing profits, obviously. All of the, every single one of these factors that you're talking about is meant to get people to buy more, get people to eat more. There's no thought given to what is this doing to the body. Maybe you could just talk about some of the side effects of what these foods are doing to us. Obesity is definitely one that is spiked, disease that's caused by these foods. What are the effects?
Well, obesity is the big one, and obesity is a disease, and obesity is a precursor to a lot of other diseases. Mm-hmm. So if you're overweight, you're out of balance. And even if you're not sick yet, you're working on sickness. So if you're walking around with 40, 50 extra pounds, there's something going on inside you that's not right. So if you're now on junk food and you just keep eating and you keep gaining weight every year, 10, 15, 20 pounds, mm-hmm. You're going towards something that you don't like. So really what we have is a nutritional wasteland. That's what I like to call that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just replete with all these tasty, inexpensive foods that people, and high calorie, of course, that people can't seem to stop eating, and they're questioning themselves saying, I'm an emotional eater. Well, now we're understanding why they're saying that. You really are emotional about it. You have a connection, and that's just hormonal. I mean, your brain is driving this inability to stop eating. So you can have a smell of food. You can have a sight. You can even read about this stuff. You can read about Cheetos and get a memory trigger that causes you to run for the bag. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how many people who've just been listening to this interview have already grabbed the bag of Cheetos? Could be. Yeah, I don't know.
Right. So this craving, though, is unlike what you would get with a whole food. Mm-hmm. I just cannot recall ever thinking about an apple and saying, I must have that apple right now. I can wait. Now, I know the apple is going to fail me. I know it's going to taste good. I know it is good for me. And I know when I eat it, I'm going to feel good. But I don't have that intense craving. A bag of chips, if you watch people shop, they won't look at it. They'll just pile drive it into their bag. And the bread and stuff that makes you feel good, right? So it's quite intense when you watch people do things unthinkingly and with feeling. So the feelings are you need the chemicals in your body driving you to cause you to reach for stuff that you wouldn't normally reach for. So one of the statistics on it is that, or if I look at the manufacturers themselves, I would say, what is it driven by? Is it driven by love? No.
Right.
There's no love in this. There's an equation to it. It's a monetary equation, right? So the overall question would be, how can we drive more junk food into more people more often?
Mm-hmm.
That's the crux of the equation of the junk food industry or the processed food industry, because it's really one and the same. So it's a lack of empathy that has caused an obesity catastrophe in this country. I'll give you an example. In 1990, no state in the U.S. had an obesity rate over 15%.
15.
Now, that's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's 1990. Now, where we are today is quite shocking, because the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said that we're at 39.8%.
What? As a nation?
As a nation. So that's
in 30 years, less than 30 years, we've gone to the worst, the most obese state in the United States was 15%. And now nationally, we're at nearly 40%.
Yes. So there wasn't a single state over 15, they said.
Mm.
So if you look at the statistics and you say, well, what does this correlate to? I mean, for us in a nutrition field, we look at cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really don't need a lot of those statistics. They can drive a lot of thought, but I can see what people reach for.
Right.
So that's roughly about 131 million people with a body mass index of 30 or over. That's an explosion of disease that's yet to happen. So if we're looking at it and saying 8 out of 10 are dying of a disease today, mm-hmm. 8 out of 10 today, that's not what's coming.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be worse, in other words.
Yeah, we're going to collapse the healthcare system.
So it's just even to be aware that you have these scientists who don't have your best interests at heart. Their motivations are definitely working against you. Let's just finish by talking about what you do to pull yourself out of that. With so many factors working against you, how do you solve this?
Right. So as a nutritional teacher myself, I've changed the way that I my approach towards this when I counsel people. Before, it was very black and white. You know, you need to really put a lot of effort into this. And quite frankly, it wasn't working.
Hmm.
If it did work, it was just by somebody just had sheer brutal willpower and they overcame it. And it does work for somebody that's strong-willed.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to educate people on what is the actual cause of it. You can't just say, well, you're eating bad. That's just too broad. Or that's like saying, I want to lose 30 pounds, but I don't know how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so one of the best sayings that I've ever heard is the educator Herbert Armstrong. And the crux of that saying is so simple, but you can apply it to all situations. So he said, eat only those natural foods that spoil and eat them before they do.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to start as the premise of something, you know, identify what a food is. A whole food is a food. A processed food is junk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really why I say junk. So if you can, Mr. Armstrong said, if you can put it on a counter and it spoils, it's a whole food. You know, it's going to do something good for your body. Processed foods really can last years. They're waiting for you. You know, that lack of goodness is there for you forever. You know, so
right.
So quitting food isn't easy. It's not easy. I'm just not going to even pretend to say somebody it's easy. It never is. And as well, if you're going to eat from a box or a can, which we will. I mean, there's stuff like, say, canned beans or something. Sometimes we're in a hurry. Make sure that when you do have a box or can, you live by the rule of six. Pronounceable, recognizable ingredients. Make sure that when you're eating something, it doesn't do untoward harm towards your body, right? So, now and then realize that the food that you like, that you crave, that you want right now, it's engineered just like a drug to pull you in into a very dark place. You know, think about that. That food isn't good for you. So, and then I will say to people, where do you want to be in 10 years? Do you have kids? Right. Do you want to play softball with them? You know, think about your future. And so that gets the process, the ball rolling towards, you know, what am I really doing to myself? So I would say just be consistent. You're going to fail at times. Just resolve with consistency to overcome. Set the right course. That's a physical course. Say, I'm going to overcome this. Map it out why. Make sure you put your family there, your children, your wife. Be around for them. And then you're acquiring habits that will give you robust health for life.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Jörg. We've been talking to Jörg Mardian about junk food and the shadowy science behind it. He's working on an article on this subject that you can watch for at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much. It was great to have you in today.
Oh, it was great to be here.
It's time for today's last word.
Should you send that text? Should you make that comment? Should you express that thought? Fewer and fewer people, it seems, even ask themselves these questions. And it's causing mayhem. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, wise Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 3. And this includes a time to keep silence. Yes, at times the thought on your mind is best left right where it is, unspoken, untexted. Sadly, this is becoming less and less common sense. Our world is faster than ever. News, facts, opinions, judgments, hot takes, and reactions circle the world in a blink. People not only say all that's on their minds, they text, tweet, chat, blog, or vlog it too, without hesitation. It's never a good idea to speak without a filter. Knowing when to keep your mouth closed or your thumbs off your phone is a critical life skill, and God has a lot to teach us about it. The Bible brims with admonitions to control what you say and warnings of the woe you'll cause if you don't. This invaluable guidance is doubly true of texting and posting online. Proverbs 18 verse 2 says, "A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion." Is there any better description of what triggers a majority of social media posts? If you aren't restraining your words, God bluntly labels you a fool. Ecclesiastes 5 says, "Be not rash with your mouth. A fool's voice is known by a multitude of words." Proverbs 15:2 says, "The mouth of fools," and we could add their phone, "pours forth foolishness." A little thinking and you quickly discern the wisdom in these proverbs. He who guards his mouth preserves his life. He who opens wide his lips comes to ruin. He who restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. He who keeps his mouth and his tongue keeps himself out of trouble. This advice is important in what you say, and it's essential in what you text or post. Online, that offhand comment can easily reach ears and eyes you never intended and cause untold damage to others' reputation and your own. Schools, employers, and others are scrutinizing people's online fingerprints and making decisions about admissions, hirings, and life opportunities accordingly. What you post can live on. It can be difficult or impossible to erase. Many people are frustrated to find their lives coming to ruin because of ill-considered comments or pictures they posted, even as teenagers. This is one more reason we ought to all heed the Apostle James. Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to text, slow to tweet, we could add, slow to wrath. If any man among you seem to be religious and bridles not his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is vain. Proverbs 29:20 says, "Do you see a man who is hasty in his words? There is more hope for a fool than for him." The Bible's wisdom gets more specific about one area where far too many people have grown far too comfortable letting their opinions fly. That is criticism and condemnation. When your mind pings with a condemning thought, it is definitely a time to keep silent. James 4:11 says plainly, "Speak not evil one of another, brethren." The Apostle Paul says we ought to speak evil of no man. Why is this so important? Ignoring this wisdom destroys relationships, ruins reputations, and adds bitterness and grief to your life. Proverbs 12:18 says, "There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing." Honestly evaluate. Do your words wound or do they heal? At its heart lies this simple truth. God's way of life is give, love, outgoing concern for others. Satan's way is get, putting self first. The urge to criticize springs from the second of those. You trumpet others' mistakes or weaknesses to knock them down a notch. You tell that juicy story to feel superior and get a laugh, not even considering whether you have the whole story, how it might hurt the person, whether he or she deserves the courtesy of privacy, or how you would want others to handle it if that unflattering tidbit were about you. Gossip, rumor, and slander have bedeviled all human history, but now they're amplified by smartphones and social media. With the scuttle of thumbs on a little screen, gossipy goodies can resound around the world within seconds. The ego kick is potent and addictive, and God hates it. He commands in Leviticus 19, "You shall not go up and down as a talebearer among your people." And with 4G and Wi-Fi, you can go up and down without even leaving your seat. And even more than that, the next verse says, "You shall not hate your brother in your heart." God wants you to bridle not just your lips and your fingers, but your mind and your heart. Live the give way. Think on the good and praiseworthy in others. Show kindness and respect. Speak what builds up, what heals, not hurts. And learn the godly wisdom in recognizing a time to keep silence. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Nachtigall, Ariana Eames, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to Jesse Hester and Steve Herkus for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Nothing is more highly to be prized than the value of each day. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.